This is a talk on the elements handled in processing. It could also be called the elements of existence. Very little difference these days. Let's just take a fast rundown on what these things are. One is the person himself. What are the component parts of the individual? The field of religion, the field of physics, the field of biology, actually themselves are efforts of a sort of an only one classification to study a fragment of the individual. Each one is a fragment. And therefore, these things are each one a fragment of the truth. Let's just look at this then. Man has divided things into these categories. He's divided them into the field of the physical sciences, as represented by physics and chemistry, the life sciences, which really aren't sciences by definition at all, since they do not progress along orderly axioms, but those life sciences such as biology, anthropology, and so forth. And then let's look over at the other field, and we find out there's religion, and religion is only one heading, and the rest of the group could be spiritualism, occultism, magic, the normal activities of barbaric and civilized peoples to understand the spirit or soul of man. Now, if we see that man's knowledge is divided into these parts, then it must follow that man must have some empathy with each one of these sciences. Is that right? There must be then a component part in man which would compare to each one of these fields. And we call these fields the fields of, just let's be very simple about it, and call it religion, biology, and physics. All right, we have then three fields. These are each one representative of a whole family of sciences. And we see that man does have then something in relationship with each one of these fields. Otherwise, he wouldn't be interested in these fields. Let's get as simple as that. All right? What is it in man that corresponds, then, to the field of physics? It would be the material objects which he uses, handles, or associates with. That'd be one part of it, and another part of it would be those energies, raw physical universe energies, which an individual employs in order to transport himself, in order to communicate, and so forth. These would essentially be a part of man because they are the things that man owns. In psychoanalysis, this could have been called, and was never called or so classified, but could very well have been called the alter ego, those things which surround the centrality of man. His objects, his possessions, the physical energies he uses, and the space in which he exists. All right? That's where physics comes in. Now, where does biology come in? Well, this comes in with the cells. The cells themselves, the organisms which are built out of cells, the plants, fungus, bacteria, all these other things with which man is associated, and his body itself, which of course has in each case a representative part, which is biological. And this part can be traced on an evolutionary chain. It's been something else. It's changed into what it is now. And you run out from this till you find a whole culture of organisms. And if you merely considered man an organism, you would have a whole culture which would be a society. Well, like our modern society here. All right? So that would be another component part. As far as biology is concerned, it would be those mobile or relatively immobile life forms which man associates with or is. All right. What about religion over here, though? You realize religion is the oldest subject that man has studied. It is very easily the oldest subject with which man has been associated. Well, if we're going to say, well, there's no truth in religion, if there isn't any basis to operate on there at all, we would be saying immediately there is no grounds for any sympathy in man. In other words, if we said man does not have a soul, we would then have to say man is not interested in religion. But of all the things that man is interested in, religion has been the most persistent on the whole track. We can trace back man's interest in religion for 4,500 years of written history. So, obviously, there's some component part there. Well, this is very much the case. A man has a spirit, and he is his spirit. And his personality, his thinkingness, his aesthetic, and so forth, is a spirit. Now, Dianetics would have gone quite a distance if we had merely been able to reduce engrams and straighten up life as a form. You should recognize Dianetics as a study of the biological level of man. This is biology, and it's not much of an excursion into physics, and it's certainly hardly any excursion at all into man as a spirit. But there's a wider truth here to be observed, that man is a soul, he is a spirit. We don't care what words we use here particularly, but it is something which is capable of creation and destruction, which is capable of the origin of space, and is capable of the origin of energy and matter. Now, this is observable by test. Well, what happened in Dianetics? Well, first we'd have to recognize what's happened to man. Let's take this field over here of the spirit, the beingness, the central beingness of a person, and let's take that as one extreme, and then over on the other side here, let's take physics, chemistry, in other words, the material universe, space, energy, and matter, and its time, of course, as the physical side, and call it the extreme physical side. So now we have the extreme spiritual side, the extreme physical side. And those two things, when combined, make the biological group of knowingness. Now, man has not looked at himself very well, and so he recognizes in himself a life form, and he tries to composite out of this life form the idea that a cell is just a cell. The very, very uninformed physicist, not the nuclear physicist, certainly, but the mere physicist, has constantly today sought to prove that life arises out of matter. And he gets no place with these experiments. He just keeps running up against it. He doesn't get any place at all. He tries to trace a piece of mud, and out of this piece of mud arises a virus, and out of that virus rises another form, which we call the very small cell, and that develops, and eventually we have a life organism. This theory does not work. It observably doesn't work, because until the advent of Dianetics, man did not have any human science. He had a lot of things he called human science, merely because he saw there was a need for them, and he tried to fill in this gap. But here, by the way, was psychology. That's what psychology is. It is the study which stems from the fully physical side of existence and seeks to trace the evolution of man from mud, really, because the scientists who have originated, beginning with Wundt, the German, applying scientific methodology, didn't just apply scientific methodology, they applied the scientific items of matter, energy, and space, and tried to get out of matter, energy, and space the totality, which we call beingness, and as a matter of fact, the last textbook, practically the most recent one issued in the field of psychology, registers itself as an entire and complete defeat. It says a definition of psychology is not possible without tracing its history. Now, that's a fine don't look, isn't it? You can always define something without tracing its history. Define the United States. And then we say, well, we can't define the United States until we've traced its history. Now, the second line in the opening book, the first line says that it has no definition. The second line says the word psychology is derived from psyche and logos. And psyche means the spirit, and logos means discourse. But this word no longer applies because psychology is, direct quote, is not a study of the spirit, nor even of the mind. They just wipe themselves out, in other words. psychology is not a study of the mind or spirit. And you who think that psychology is a study of the mind are trying to fill man's need for a study of the mind with this word, psychology. You see, psychology is not the study of the spirit or even the mind. It's not a study of the mind and spirit. It's an experimental application of bric-a-brac to collect data. Now, don't say data about what? It just collects data. Now, of course, it sought to come out of the field of philosophy. And it came out of that branch of philosophy which dedicates itself to the physical sciences. There isn't any reason to go on with this any further. I'm just trying to show you that here we had an extreme view. And the day you get any physicist who is, you know, he's just been to the university, he is a physicist, he has no broader background than that, you will find this individual pressing forward very hard, trying to evolve every behavior in life out of Newton's laws or some such thing. And the biologist, to some degree, followed suit. But the biologist was closer to it. He was actually studying the component parts of life, which consist of cells and bodies. And he studied cells and bodies, but he tried to make this an end-all. He tries to explain everything. He says that biology, by the way, does not agree with its parent science, cytology, which is the study of cells. Primary science is cytology. Biology has had to be popularized so that it would agree with the people. More than cytology does. But cytology lays down the principle that life is actually an accidental outgrowth of an unending stream of protoplasm which goes through time from its earliest moment until now. And that all possible forms and shapes, sizes and behaviors that life is going to produce are inherent in that unending line of protoplasm. They have reduced everything down, you should say, really, to the, when they mean an unending line of protoplasm, they mean the sperm-ovum trail that goes back into the dimmest past. Now, that is cytology, and biology comes out of that and tries to study the form. Cytology actually studies this unending line of protoplasm, and biology studies the form. So there is that field. And yet that field was far closer to anything man could use, certainly, than these offshoots that were originated out of the field of physics. Because man does not come out of mud, because mud does not behave like man. Nor does mud contain the potentials which will make man behave like man behaves. Mud is very, very easily controlled stuff. And man is not. And the physicist who goes out and tries to control man with mud, which is to say he tries to hold him in line with force, shotguns, shackles, jails, and so forth, just produces fiasco after fiasco in terms of empire. He's got no place by doing this. And yet he has been demonstrating this for thousands of years. And by actual experiment in the business of living, we find then that the physical picture is not workable. This total physical picture that says man came from mud, that's not workable. We look over here at biology, and in spite of the fact that we have now had biology, and very good biology, since long before Pasteur, in spite of the fact we've had biology for almost a century in the form which is now being taught in high schools, I mean, it's that old. It's an old, old science. We yet have very, very little advance on the subject of making cells do something predictably. There's very little advance in that. They just take the inherent components of what cells do and they can modify it slightly. They found out that the application of X-rays will mutate, that is, to change the growth ratio and growth form. They have found out that you can put certain moles in combination with certain bacteria, and the bacteria will die. But then, man, that's nothing new. It just happens to be the fact that the antibiotics, these moles, do not kill off the whole organism. That's new. But man has always been able to introduce a small amount of arsenic into a body and have it die. And actually, arsenic itself is the earliest historical item on the antibiotic list. Arsenic itself was utilized for many, many hundreds of years by witches in Europe. The only doctors they had in Europe were witches. And the witch came into disrepute when all of Europe turned over to religion. They abandoned herbs and so forth and went over for the spirit exclusively. But up to that time, they'd been using arsenic in this way. They'd give an individual enormous numbers of doses, each dose very tiny. And every day, this individual would take one of these tiny doses of arsenic, and he would eventually become proof against disease. And one of the things that made the European culture so suspicious of witches was a very simple one. They would dig them up, Lord knows how long later, and find the body of these witches perfectly preserved, because these witches were arsenic eaters, and the body would not decay in the grave. You see what chance a mere bacteria had that floated into this body, which was conditioned with arsenic. Well, they immediately had enormous numbers of bacteria were inactive then against the witches, so they could live through plagues, syphilis, any type of disease of that character. None of these diseases were effective against these witches, and arsenic gives a person a rather pleasant color. Gives them pink cheeks and so forth, and they dig up some witch 25 years after they're buried. They're dug up the rest of the graveyard. They find everybody rotted and dust and a few ragged bones and rather messy, and here they be these witches perfectly preserved. So they says they must continue to use their bodies after they're dead. So the only way to kill a witch is to drive a stake through his chest. And all kinds of nonsense originated in this line. That was the end of witchcraft. Anyway, here was the earliest stages, you might say, of practical biology. That's practical biology. And today, this same tradition is followed through with such things as penicillin, oreomycin, chloromycetin, about a dozen specifics which the biochemists have been able to originate. The biochemist there, you see, is operating straight in the line of the cell, the organism, and he says it behaves certain laws and has to feed in this way and that way, and he traces his way through. But if this was true, if this was all there was this biological strata, then you would, of course, expect that every problem of the organism would have been solved by a biological approach. If it was a total truth, you would have gotten a total solution. Well, you got nothing even vaguely resembling a total solution. Today, penicillin is less and less effective. And they have to do other things today to make somebody well. And biology actually is just one jump ahead of the ability of the cell to proof itself and square itself around. Well, they can handle everything, everything then, but the ability of the cell to defend itself. They can't handle that. Cell wins sooner or later. All right, what about religion? Is this a total and an all? Where we're concerned. After all, we're a society, and we have individually and collectively various interests and so forth. Well, is religion an end answer? Well, certainly not as practiced. Religion itself has been responsible, probably, for more deaths, just as itself. It's been responsible for more deaths and more unhappiness than any other single item. Dictators, plague, these things are actually very small compared to the amount of damage which has been done by religion in the name of peace. In the name of peace, we have had nothing but endless war. Religion broke its back, by the way, finally on that point, for a long while. Religion taught nothing but peace, 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 turn the other cheek, peace. Man is a spirit, save your soul, be good, go to heaven, get your reward, or if you don't, well, you'll go to hell and burn forever. And it taught this philosophy that we must have peace, peace, peace. And World War I found troops of one side finding the dead bodies of troops of the other side on the battlefield with such legends as "Gott mittens" on their belt buckles. Well, God was on the other side, see? God was on their side. God was on the other fellow's side. God was on everybody's side because it was a Christian cataclysm. And it broke the back of Christianity because it almost entirely ruined the faith of troops in Christianity. Up to that time, the major wars had been fought against major faiths. It was sort of Catholic against Protestant. It was one faith against another faith. Christian against Mohammedan. The godlessness of the Mongol versus the Christian Europe. They're big cataclysmic wars that had this sort of a division. But World War I was not of this character. It was Christian against Christian. Just like that, and each side was trying to pep up its own troops with the idea that God was on their side. They wore it out. Naturally, there followed a very godless area. There was no more godless area in the Christian world than that one which immediately succeeded World War I. And today, Christianity hasn't gotten on its feet. But if you were to follow all the principles in government and so forth, which are laid down in the name of the spirit, the soul, so on, if you were to follow these exactly, you'd have an awful mess on your hands. You see, we've actually had periods when these were followed exactly, very, very close to exactly. The first time they were ever followed brought upon the crash of the biggest and grandest and most plentiful society that we'd had on earth, the Roman Empire. Edward Gibbon writes there, I don't know how many million words Edward Gibbon wrote in the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, but his private purpose in writing that book was to demonstrate the actual action of Christianity in a society. That was his purpose in writing the book. Ostensibly, he was very interested in the Roman Empire. And because it is a scholarly study of the Roman Empire, it can still be bought in its entirety. Otherwise, it long ago would have been put on an index expurgatorius. It's an interesting book. It tells you that whereas the Roman nation was responsible for about 10 purges of Christians, and that there were probably less than 100,000 Christians in all the purges combined with the Roman Empire, there were probably less than 100,000 Christians who were arrested and imprisoned or condemned. And that was over a period of a long while. That was over a period of centuries. There were only about 30 Christians in that first purge, the first Roman push against Christians. There were only about 30 Christians who were martyred in that time. And yet the Christians themselves slaughtered 100,000 of their own people in 1 year of rioting in one city in the Roman Empire, Alexandria. In 1 year, the Christians themselves murdered more Christians than were murdered in 10 purges officially conducted by the Roman Empire. Now, it tells you there must be some mad dogness in this, isn't it? There's been more inhumanity conducted in the name of religion than under any other heading. I saw a wonderful book one time. It covered the life of Torquemada. It was oddly and symbolically bound in human skin. It's in a library down in Pacific Groves, California. It's in Spanish. It's a very, very old book, The Life of Torquemada. The Spanish Inquisition. The bloody chapters which have been written back through history in the name of Christianity and peace tell us that it doesn't apparently operate all by itself as a good operation point. You know, if we're going to consider the health of a society, if we just said all is now going to be operated from the standpoint of religion, we would be making a considerable error if we wish to bring about anything like a pleasant or peaceful or progressive culture. This is no condemnation of Christianity or a condemnation of man. We're just facing a few facts here. The world under the rule of religion has not been successful or peaceful. This we can see with a good, clear glance at history. Take the Crusades. I don't think there's any more disgraceful chapter, actually, in the history of Christianity than these battles fought for loot in the name of religion. The enormous numbers of people who died of disease and homelessness. You take the Child's Crusade. These are bitter chapters in our culture because America is essentially a portion of the European culture. You can call the American culture, European culture, more or less the same cultures, and these succeed the Roman culture, which only indifferently succeeds the Greek culture. But here's one line of culture, and we look at this, we can ask ourselves, has it been terrifically improved by the introduction of religion? And if we consider by improvement calmness, happiness, the ability to get, beget, and to live, why, we just, as people looking for data and so forth, could not put our vote in the direction of, let's be exclusively religious. Let's favor nothing but this spirit. And then out of this spirit, monitor all of our thoughts and activities. We certainly wouldn't have a culture. It would be chaos itself. All right. Whether you agree with that or not agree with that, because it's not propaganda, I'm merely trying to tell you that here, over here, we have this tremendous extremity. We have, everybody says, life is really caused by this mud. That's a terrible extreme. And over here, life must be totally monitored by this spirit. And that's all there is, and it can't do anything else but face up to God and do this and do that and conduct itself spiritually and religiously. And it says that over here, you see, and that's an extreme. And we find out neither one of these things have really succeeded, because at this moment, the idea that man is actually mud gives adequate license to the government and its physicists to manufacture sufficient weapons to destroy all the civil populaces of Earth. How can they bring their conscience to do this? Simply by saying, well, man's just mud anyhow. He has no right to happiness. He has no spirit. He has nothing. He's just animated rocks. Knock him off. Kill him. Kill everybody. It's insanity. You have your rights in the face of such a proposed cataclysm. Actually, no government has the right to a single life. Not even one life. We're not saying now we don't believe or should believe in capital punishment, but you see, a government is not alive. It is an organism only so far as it is consented to by other organisms. And to say that a piece of paper up here has the right to a human being, oh no, it doesn't. Not by a long way. And yet, there's an extreme view. All is mud. Doesn't work. Extreme view, all is a spirit. Doesn't work. Truth must be someplace else. Well, it's closer in the field of biology. Actually, biology is making life better for people. Physics isn't. Religion isn't. Because they're both too extreme. So there must be a closer truth in here. Well, let's take a look at Dianetics and find out that Dianetics was actually a biological mental study. Biological mental study. That's a biological hyphen mental. That's what it was. And I call your attention to issue 28G of the Journal of Scientology, which gives Scientology a new science, written in 1947. And there is actually the entering point. That's where we enter the picture. We say, look, we have cells and bodies, and the cells are trying to survive, and the bodies are trying to survive, and they live in colonial aggregations, and we multiply this out, and we see these cultures existing. And this is what we can see with our naked eye. Without much assistance, we can see that we do have cells, and we do have bodies, and we can see that these organisms are thinking. So what are they thinking about? Well, if the cell is trying to survive, and the body's trying to survive, therefore the thinkingness must be on the subject of survival. See? And therefore, the intelligence is the ability to resolve problems relating to survival. So we get a law there. Does it work? Believe me, it worked.